This episode of the Commerce Marketer Podcast is brought to you by the Bronto Marketing Platform, a flexible yet powerful software that helps you grow revenue, save time, and optimize marketing resources. If you're interested in making sophisticated email marketing easy, visit bronto.com. That's B-R-O-N-T-O.com. As an email marketer, how do you persuade a subscriber to open your email, click it, and convert from it? The power and science of persuasion matters. Today, we are going to make you a better email marketer by discussing how to apply the science of human behavior to online and email marketing. Welcome inside the Commerce Marketer Podcast Studio. I'm your host, Greg Zachwitz, and right now, I want to persuade you to listen. Today, we're going to discuss how to apply the behavioral science to create persuasive emails from subject lines and email creative through effective landing pages. Let me introduce to you someone who knows the benefits of applying the science of human behavior to online marketing, Nancy Harhut, co-founder and chief creative officer at HBT Marketing. Welcome to the show, Nancy. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Greg. Great to be here.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time. Nancy, as we get started today, let's do a little baseline backgrounds here. So can you take a couple minutes just to give the audience a little background about what you do, who HBT Marketing is, and how you help marketers and companies?
Absolutely. Thank you for asking. So I'm the Chief Creative Officer of HBT Marketing. And what we do is we live at the intersection of marketing best practices and behavioral science. So we provide our clients a added advantage by applying what social scientists and behavioral economists have found about how people make decisions to marketing best practices. So we take what has been proven about how people make decisions, and we layer that on top of established direct marketing best practices. And together that provides a 1-2 punch and increases the likelihood that people will do what our clients want them to do. So the next question might be, well, what if social scientists found about how people make decisions? And in a nutshell, what they found is that very often people rely on decision defaults, that they make decisions without really thinking about them in the moment. Very often they just respond automatically and instinctively. And if a marketer knows that and can build some of the prompts or triggers that cause people to default to a decision into their strategies and their executions, it increases the likelihood they'll get the response they're looking for.
Excellent. And we are going to spend some time talking about some of those specifics from, like I mentioned, subject lines and creative today. Most important question of the day for you, Nancy. You're a BU alum. I married a BC alum. Are you going to hold that against me?
No, not at all. As a matter of fact, I live in Newton, and Newton is home to BC, and I've spoken at BC before, great school. So not that BU isn't a great school, also a great school, but I think we're on good terms today, not to worry.
Very good. And the Buffalo Sabres best player is a BU. Well, he's not really an alum. He never graduated, but he's a BU player. So I'm fully supporting BU here.
Well, there you go. Okay.
Nancy, when it comes to, we're going to talk about email marketing, of course, and we can kind of look at this approaching it by steps, right? So the first step is really get someone to open the email. And once they open, we need to convey the message quickly and yes, still provide value that encourages that click. And then we shift to conversion. So I'm going to try, and this is really on me, I'm going to try to follow this pattern and guide you along with persuasion tactics along the way. So from there, let's actually start with subject lines. So email marketers, they commonly ask when I was doing consulting about how to write effective subject lines. And, you know, the conversation was always around, hey, what's considered a good subject line? It always really, really seemed to be subjective in nature. So the question, I guess, is it actually subjective? And if not, are there insights or tips you can share with the listeners as to either how to affect a more compelling subject line or maybe just ways to rethink their school of thought when it comes to what actually makes a good subject line?
Sure. So I think it's maybe a little less subjective than some people might think. There are definitely some proven techniques that can be used that will increase the likelihood someone will open your email or will be attracted to your subject line. And, you know, there are certain, I guess, kind of basics. These days, so many people read their emails on a mobile device. You know, simply trying to keep your character count to about 35 characters or less is a good thing. That way you can ensure your message doesn't get cut off. But then beyond that, what I like to do is I recommend to my clients that we use a healthy amount of what are known as eye magnet words. There's been a lot of research that proves that some words are just more attractive to the human eye. They jump off the screen and attract the eye like a magnet. And so those are the words that I like to recommend we use you know, when appropriate, of course. So words like new, for example, there's a whole family of new words, new, now, introducing, announcing, finally, soon. And the reason those words work so well is the human brain is hardwired to crave the new and novel. We're constantly looking for that next new thing because when we think we found it, it releases dopamine and that feels good. It's kind of the feel-good hormone. So as a result, we're constantly jonesing for that next hit of dopamine, constantly looking for that next new thing. So if you can use new, now, introducing, announcing, finally, soon, that's a really good thing to do. In fact, I think it's Copyblogger that listed new as one of the top five most persuasive words in the English language. And then I came across a study from Adestra. They found the word alert can get you a 33.1% lift in your opening rates based on their studies. And the reason there is human beings are hardwired to be scanning the metaphorical horizon, if you will, always looking for danger so that we can avoid it. We're constantly trying to avoid danger. And if we see the word alert, it telegraphs to us that there might be danger on the horizon. There might be something we need to pay attention to. And so as a result, we focus. And as email marketers, trying to get people to open our emails, if we can get someone to focus on our subject line, that can be a very good thing. Personalization also works very well. Experian ran a study. They found personalizing a subject line can get you somewhere between a 25% and 30% increase in your opening rates. People are attracted to their names. And as a result, when you're scanning your inbox and you're trying to decide what to open, your eye locks on your name and attracts attention. And next thing you know, boom, you're opening that email. So there are a number of different techniques that that we can use as email marketers to try to get people to zero in on that subject line. Another one that comes to mind is rooted in something known as the von Restorff effect. And what social scientists have found is the human brain is hardwired to notice and remember things that stand out. So anything we can do to a subject line to make it stand out from all the other ones that happen to be in the inbox that day is a good thing. So emojis, for example, ellipses, brackets, parentheses, capping one or two keywords. These are all great ways to make the subject line look a little bit different and call attention to itself based on everything else that shows up in that email box. Now, this said, I will allow that things change. And if everyone starts using emojis, for example, they'll begin to cancel each other out. The word free, for example, used to be a terrible word because it would flag the spam filters. You'd never want to use it in your subject lines. There's a company called World Data. They study about 6 billion emails every year. They have found that over the last 5 years, free is the top performing subject line word. So I think maybe where the subjectivity might come in is because things have a tendency to change. And so as a result, we should always be testing.
I want to respond to a couple of things you said. One, I'll pick up right where you left off with the word free. And I would absolutely agree with you. I think that's one of those things that have kind of was rooted back in the 15-year-old kind of quote-unquote spam days where, you know, you actually had legit spammers there. Obviously, podcasts on deliverability, shameless plug there, go back a few episodes, deep dive in that. So I would absolutely agree with you there. And I like how you mentioned emojis because I was going to ask you about that as well. And I do a holiday prep presentation analysis every single year, and I'm signed up for hundreds of retailer emails, and I scan through literally close to 1,000 a day during the holiday seasons. And I do a section on subject lines that appeal to me that just kind of jumped out. And a lot of them this past year and even the year before, but this past year, emoji driven, right? And it's amazing to me how popular they are and yet how little they're really used during some of the busiest times of the year. And you have, you know, the reason they stand out is because there's few companies that are actually doing it. So I like the use of emojis there. So I think that kind of corresponds to some of the things you mentioned. Quick question on subject lines from a B2B and B2C standpoint. Obviously, I'm going to cater a lot of the conversation today around the B2C side, but some of these things certainly hold true on the B2B side. Have you found, just from your experience, subject lines on the B2B space to be very similar to the B2C side with, you know, some of these things like new and free and that same direction there?
So in that respect, yes. I mean, some of these eye magnet words appeal to us as people, and we're people whether we're at home or at the office. So if you have something that's new, if you're introducing something, if you're putting a new spin on something, that has a large appeal whether you're in B2B or B2C. Free does very well. There was a study that that World Data did in conjunction with their looking at the word free, and they found that free got twice as many opens as complimentary. And you might think, well, you know, complimentary is a little classier, perhaps. Maybe I should use that. I mean, obviously it takes more characters, but sometimes we might feel, well, maybe in a B2B environment, we don't want to say it's free, we'll say it's complimentary, but free actually gets twice as many opens as complimentary. So with respect to some of these iMagnet words, I find that they're working on the B2B and the B2C side. I think where there are some differences is some B2C emails maybe have a different brand voice or tonality and can take a slightly different approach. And that might be where you see some, some relaxation. Maybe you're seeing some of these shorter, punchier, curiosity-oriented subject lines that might work a little bit better there than in B2B, where a company wouldn't feel particularly comfortable with that kind of an approach. But those are some, more of the nuances from a behavioral science perspective. Some of these things that we're talking about, iMagnet words, another thing is the idea of urgency or exclusivity. These are all principles that apply, equally as well, B2B or B2C.
Very cool. So let's shift from subject line. All right. So we have these iMagnet words we're using and we're collecting the open. And then we want to talk about strategies for what happens when the subscriber actually opens email. How do we get them to, one, look at that email and focus their attention, then two, drive that behavior to click? So I want to start on the social proof side. I recently wrote an article about using social proof inside of email, which came out in mid-September. We're obviously pre-recording this. And I know you've spoken about social proof before. So can you briefly explain to the audience what the concept of social proof is, and then share your perspective, if you would, on how to use social proof in both email marketing and on websites, if possible?
Sure. So what behavioral economists and social scientists have found is that when people are uncertain of what decision to make, they often look to others, particularly others like themselves, and they follow their lead. So you could say that, we're a nation of followers, right? If we're not really sure what to do, we look around, we see what someone else is doing, we say, okay, I guess I'll do that. Some people refer to it as social proof. Other people refer to it as herd mentality. Some scientists talk about social norms, but it's all basically the same concept. And I think it's very effective, really, for email marketers. It can be very effective for email marketers because we're trying to get people to make a decision in the moment, and they may or may not have a clear understanding of what they want to do. They may not have the time to do a lot of research, and so they want to just make a decision, and they're going to rely on one of these decision defaults, and social proof is a very good decision default. So there are a number of different ways that we can trigger social proof in our emails and in our landing pages. Anytime we say something is a popular product, or it's our fastest growing category, or this is our most visited site, or this is our best selling product, or this is our top ranked service, those are all great examples of social proof. And what they'll do is they'll telegraph to people, okay, this is a good choice for me. Other people have used this and they seem to be happy. Therefore, I feel like it'll be a good choice for me. I can feel comfortable making this choice. Other ways to trigger social proof would be to feature something that was previously sold out and to say, this sold out in the past, but it's now back in stock. And that will make somebody think, gee, I better get in on this before it disappears again. Other people are buying this. Other people are signing up for this. I'll probably like it too. Or simply telling someone, a product or a service is expected to sell out. We could talk about the number of customers somebody has, or maybe the number of people currently looking at a particular product or option, or the number of recent sales. Amazon made famous the "people like you also bought" phrase. So those are all great ways to trigger social proof. Another terrific way to do it is through the use of testimonials. Testimonials are an awesome example of social proof because while people sometimes doubt what a marketer is saying, they feel much more comfortable believing what somebody like them says. And I always say to my clients, there are two ways to take a good testimonial and turn it into a great one. The first way is to make sure that the testimonial giver is very similar to the testimonial receiver. So if you're trying to convince families with young children, have a testimonial from someone who has a family with young children. If you're trying to convince entrepreneurs, have a testimonial from an entrepreneur. But the closer the testimonial reader and testimonial giver are, the better off you are, because again, people trust people who are similar to themselves. And then the other thing you want to do, if possible, is start where your prospect is, which is very often in a place of skepticism. They're wondering, should I or should I not buy this? Is it as good as the marketer says it is? Is it any better than my current solution? Is it worth my time and effort to find out? And anytime you can start there and then bring the reader along on the journey to happy, satisfied customer, the better off you are. So instead of saying, you know, I love Acme, I think they're a fabulous company, if you had a testimonial that said, you know, I used to think all insurance companies were the same, but then I tried Acme, they're a fabulous company, and I'm totally glad that I chose them. You start where that person is, like, oh, they're all the same, aren't they? And then when somebody says that, you read that in the testimonial and you think to yourself, that's exactly what I'm thinking. This person thought the same thing. They took the leap of faith and tried this, and now I feel I can too. So these are all great ways to trigger the idea of social proof, and it really is a very common decision-making default.
So what I like about that is you kind of see this play out on social media, right? We talk about social proof, but social media with the trending, right? Everything is just kind of trending now, but that follows along the same line. It's like, this is what everyone else is checking out or doing and things like that. And you just kind of get that herd mentality. So I think it's applicable beyond just email. I like how you mentioned people respond to people like them. So my follow-ups was going to be, it doesn't really matter. Does age matter here? And it doesn't sound like it does, as long as the quote-unquote spokesperson is along their demographic and fits with their lifestyle behavior. So that's great. I really love what you said, Nancy, about starting from a place of skepticism, because I think that's a trap that a lot of retailers fall into. And I've talked to a lot of them, just casual conversations. When a new, whether it's an email subscriber or a new browser goes to someone's website or in the store, there's always these obstacles to conversion. Yeah, they're considering you, but they've got to get over maybe shipping policies, or they've got to trust your brand, or they got to expect you to have the best customer service. And you have all these different things that factor into a purchase relationship. And there's so few that, and it's probably because of tunnel vision, that they start looking at this and say, well, we've got the best price, or we've got the best product, and people should buy from us there. But they often don't put themselves in the customer's shoes or would-be customer's shoes. So I love the comment about starting from a place of skepticism. And as a marketer, hey, how do we overcome that skepticism there? So I really love what you said there. I think it's a great answer. So let's talk about that email. So if we want to start from a place of skepticism, put ourselves in the customer's shoes and say, okay, I'm looking at this email. What are some things in that email that, and you've mentioned some of it already from the social proof side, but what are some of the things in the email that kind of resonate to people? Are there certain colors or placement or types of images, or what makes kind of a good email creative?
So I think one of the things that we really need to keep in mind as marketers is we want to make sure that our emails are very you-focused. And very often in marketing, it's all about what we want to say, what we, the marketer, want to say. Yeah, you know, we've got this great product and we totally believe in it. And maybe we spent a lot of time and effort and money bringing it to market, or maybe we've just enhanced it. So we're very excited to get all of the information out there and to talk about all of the features that we've loaded into a product or a service. And it's all about what we want to tell people. And sometimes we lose sight of the fact that that's not the way we should be marketing. What we should be focused on instead is what people want from us, you know, what they want to learn from us, what they're looking for. We should really be focusing on our customers and our prospects and how we can solve their problems. So if we think about things through the lens of what is my prospect trying to achieve, and this is, you know, B2B or B2C, because even in a B2B environment, you know, you're trying to either look good to your boss or make sure you get out of work at 5 o'clock every day, or you're, you know, trying to answer to the shareholders. But, you know, there's always a personal stake in our decisions. And if we can start to serve up our messages based on how we're going to solve a problem for a prospect, or how we're going to help that prospect achieve a goal or a dream of theirs, we're in a much better place. And that's, I think that's a basic tenet that we need to hold on to as we're crafting our emails. If we spend too much time saying what we want to say and not enough time saying what somebody wants to hear, we're going to lose them, and we're going to lose a sale as a result. So having something that's well-targeted, that's relevant, that's motivating, you know, that has a good offer, that's you-focused, these are, I think, all hallmarks of smart performance-based emails.
Are there any types of images or things like that that resonate well with others? Or does it not really matter as long as the message or the creative kind of explains in a quick manner what it's really trying to convey? So, you know, whether the person in there is looking at you or looking away, does it not matter as long as the subscriber can look at that and say, okay, I know what that's conveying. I can understand it quickly and I know where to click there. Does it matter on certain aspects like that or no?
So I think it does. I mean, it's funny. Some of my clients have seen great success with no imagery, and others want imagery and they've seen great success using it. When we're using images, faces have a tendency to work well. Human beings are hardwired to look at other people's faces, particularly their eyes. So if you're going to use a face, you know, have the eye making eye contact, which is always a good thing, or have the eyes looking where you want your viewer or your reader's eyes to look. That provides a nice visual cue because we're hardwired to look at other people's faces, particularly their eyes. We're also hardwired to follow eye gaze. So having the eyes look at the form field that you want someone to fill out, or looking at the special offer that you're highlighting, or looking at the product that you're featuring is a good thing. You know, having the eyes look off page is not a good thing because they'll take your reader off page or off the email and away from what you want them to do. So faces and eyes are good. Charts and graphs are good. There was an interesting study that came out of Cornell that found that having a chart or a graph could actually provide instant credibility for your copy or your text. And it wasn't that the chart or the graph was adding additional information. It wasn't that it was making the information in the copy easier to understand. The researchers concluded that it was providing scientific veracity. The mere fact that there was a chart or a graph indicated it must be true because there's a chart. I'm, you know, I'm not going to really spend a lot of time looking at this chart, but I see the chart and that means, oh, it must be true. So there are some interesting things that we can do with visuals and design elements if we choose to use them.
I'm going to put a chart in the episode description for this, just showing the happiness quotient when you're listening to the podcast and just kind of going up and to the right.
I think that's a great idea, Greg.
People will look at that and say, that's not true at all. Is there something that you commonly see in email messages or landing pages that is, I don't say it's a best practice, but it's constantly being done. It's kind of the way it's always been done. And you look at it and you just kind of cringe, the hair on the back of your neck stands up. Like, why are they doing that? Is there something that always sticks out to you that people should start breaking now?
Well, this is probably not going to come as a surprise to you, but the overuse of certain photographs, very, very cliched, you know, shots of the two hands shaking or the friendly smiling customer service rep with their headsets on. And, you know, there are just certain things that it's like, you know, you see them so often, they become wallpaper. And I believe that rather than quickly communicating a message or underscoring the message, they just start to disappear. And that's not a great thing. So that's the kind of thing. It's like, oh my gosh, if I see another one of those shots, like, please, you know, it's not helping to differentiate your message. It's not helping to underscore it. It's, you know, it's just taking up space. So I would recommend that people try for things that look a little bit different. I was doing a study for a conference that I was speaking at that was travel and destination marketers. And so I was looking at the various websites and, you know, most websites feature happy, smiling faces. Why wouldn't you? You want people to come and vacation in your destination. But one particular website, I think it was Niagara Falls, had happy smiling faces, but they took a shot of people doing face painting at some, you know, festival or event. And so you had the bonus of happy smiling faces, but that also looked different than all of the other happy smiling faces on all of the other destination websites you saw. And I thought that was a really smart move on their part because they made their visual look a little bit different than the ones, you know, their target market was likely going to encounter during their search for which destination to visit. So anytime you can, you know, use something that's just a little bit different, that stands out from the things that someone is typically going to see, that's a good thing.
That's a good example. Do you think it's because we're more socially connected, we're becoming more hardwired to look away from stock images and more to, hey, this, I could see myself there? Or do you think it's always been that way and we're just drawing attention to it now?
You know, I don't know. I've been in this business for, you know, for a few years. And, you know, I can remember railing against the overuse of stock photography 10, 15 years ago. So it might just be getting a little bit more press these days. But I think it's been a problem for a while.
Interesting. Yeah, because I could see myself now. I have two kids at home. And, you know, when we take trips, whether it's long weekends or long trips somewhere, and I'm looking around different websites, like the face painting example is a good one to me because, of course, I can look at things, but I immediately say, oh, man, there's always something to do there. They've got festivals. Like, I just imagine all these other things going on by simply looking at a face painting picture. Or I could imagine those things at least. And for me, it would be more appealing to me. So I think it was a really good example, but it certainly starts to get me thinking about what actually triggers me here.
Yeah, I think the other good thing about it, Greg, was it would help people remember it. Maybe you looked at a half a dozen different websites because you were trying to plan a trip and you remember the one that had the face painting, you know,
right?
The one that was different than all the others. And, you know, that's a very good thing for marketers. We want people to absorb our message and retain it.
So we were obviously talking about email creative when it comes to this, and we can make that easy shift. Some emails will go to product pages, some will go to landing pages, especially landing pages probably more prevalent on the B2B side. But I would assume these same tactics would apply over to the landing page as well. If my assumption is incorrect, certainly feel free to correct it for me. And even if it is correct, are there additional things that marketers should look at when it comes to landing pages that are maybe different from the actual email creative itself?
Yeah, no, I think your assumption is correct that a lot of the things we're talking about carry over. One thing that's interesting is having your email have a similar look and tone to your landing page is a very good thing to do. And we don't always do it, unfortunately, as marketers. But when somebody clicks and they land, they want to be reassured immediately that they've landed in the right place. And if they don't get that immediate reassurance, they're much more likely to bail. And so, you know, picking up the same language, referring to the offer the same way, picking up the same color scheme, having the same visual from the referring email to the landing page, these are all really smart things to do. Once somebody lands, you want to restate the benefit. I'm a big advocate of simplicity in landing pages, you know, making them very easy to scan, making sure there's no extraneous copy or extraneous design elements, just really, you know, focusing on the basics, the minimum that you need to convey your information. I think landing pages are good places for social proof, which we talked about a little bit earlier. They're also good for something known as the authority principle. Ever since we were kids, we've been taught to recognize and respect authority. So by the time we're adults, it's really ingrained in us. So if an authority tells us something, we have a tendency to believe it. If they tell us to do something, we have a tendency to do it. So, you know, this is a great place to bring in trust badges and icons and, you know, quotes from experts in a field to provide that authority endorsement. The other thing that's interesting about landing pages is sometimes we have an opportunity to display prices, and how we display prices can make a big difference. There are a lot of studies that show where on the page the price sits can make a difference. If it's sitting, say, in the upper right-hand corner, it might appear as a higher price than the exact same number sitting in the lower right-hand corner, which our brain perceives as a lower price just by where it was positioned, even if it's the exact same numbers. Some studies show that having the dollar sign be about half the size as the numeral can make the price seem more attractive, because whenever we see prices, it activates something known as the pain of paying. And that's exactly what it sounds like. You know, the parts of our brain that register pain light up when we have to pay, you know, when we have to pull money out of our checking account or our bank account or our wallet or our purse, you know, or even transfer it electronically. There's a literal pain of paying. And if we can minimize that, we're more likely to get people to make purchases. And so one way to minimize it is to minimize the size of the dollar sign. So there are lots of interesting things that we can do to landing pages to just help move the sale along or help increase the conversion rates.
You know, what came to my mind was Wrigley's gum. And I haven't chewed gum in a long time, but you know, I always remembered seeing, even as a kid, and I'm sure it's still on there, but it's probably a different price. There was always that 25-cent labeling right on the package of Wrigley's gum. If you take that principle into effect and you say, okay, I'm in the checkout aisle and I've got 20 types of gum here and I have the one that actually has the price printed on it, is that a good thing? I mean, Wrigley's still, I mean, they're doing fairly well. So I wonder what the psychological effect of having the price on the package of gum versus the labeling on the shelf itself had on sales. And is there any light you can maybe shed onto that, or just interesting anecdotes you can put on that?
That's a really good question, Greg. I hadn't really thought about that, nor have I read anything about having the price of the gum on the Wrigley's package. So as I think about it, it's like, well, all right, it's only 25 cents. You know, as you're standing there in the checkout line, it's going to be an impulse purchase, right? That's why they have all those things there. You know, you're waiting to, you know, for your turn, and you end up buying these things kind of, you know, without doing a lot of thinking. And so maybe you see 25 cents, you're like, oh, who doesn't have a quarter? That's a, you know, it's a small amount of money. Maybe it would work really well until, I don't know, Trident or someone start putting 15 cents on their packaging, and suddenly it's like, oh, that's even better. So I don't know. You know, I could see it being an aid to the purchase, because it's like, hey, it's only a quarter. Who doesn't have a quarter? On the other hand, there are probably other things that, you know, you could put on a package that would have appeal, you know, maybe talking about the new flavor that came out, you know, they'd be like, ooh, it's something new, I should try that. Or maybe talking about, you know, how somebody endorsed it and thought it was terrific. This is, you know, the celebrity choice gum, you know, so are there any number of different things people could do? You've got me thinking now, I'm going to have to do some research and find out if there's been any testing in terms of the keeping or the removal of that that price point on the gum package.
I mean, they're smart people, right? And they put it out to the market and it's been there for God knows how many years. But so I'm pretty sure they did something behind it more than just coming like some guy going, hey, let's just put the price on it. You know, I'm sitting there thinking, to your point, yeah, who doesn't have a quarter, right? When they're in the checkout line. I almost wonder if it's quarter on the package. Like, you don't have to think about it then. And then you look at Trident next to it and you're like, okay, Trident. You might assume it's a quarter, but then your eyes have to go slightly down to look at the price label and slightly. I wonder if it's just that millisecond to scroll down to look at the price. I wonder if that matters. Okay, quarter, done.
Yeah.
Let me know if you research that. Drop me an email. I'd be curious to see what you find there. So one more question before we move on. You got me thinking when you were talking about the price in the upper right and upper left, or the lower right corner as well. And this is something that you can either tell me I am flat wrong on, or back me up and give me some credence here. So no pressure. So when I was doing consulting, they still come up with studies about the color of the call to action button. And for years, I'd be hearing these things about like, oh, you know, you need to make it this color and do this and it's going to get better. And I've had clients test it. I was never really a proponent of that. I'm like, there's no way. If you have a terrible image and a terrible call to action and things like that, you could change it. You know, it's to me, it was always like putting lipstick on a pig. And if it's a good call to action and a good message and it conveys everything, they're going to click. Now, you could tell me I'm completely wrong. Does the color of a call to action button matter?
So in my opinion, it does, but it's not that you have to use one color or another. It's just you want a color that's going to contrast with everything else in your email or on your landing page. And that's simply because it's going to make it stand out and make it easier to find. So people are skimming and scanning. And if that button is just a different color, it jumps out at you. Now, that said, if you have no inclination to, you know, to click, if you don't want the product, the color of the button isn't going to make a difference, you know, but assuming you've done everything else right, you know, and you've got this great product or service with these fabulous benefits and it's properly targeted and the price is right. And maybe there's a great offer that goes along with it. And, you know, you've served up all the right benefits. One more thing that's going to help is to have that button jump out. And in order to make it jump out, you know, choosing a contrasting color. So a lot of times the art directors I work with want the, you know, the piece to look beautiful, and they want all the colors to, you know, to just blend in and create this harmonious look. And that's fine and it looks lovely, but we're not in the business of creating art. We're in the business of creating business, right? Of creating sales. And so making it easy for that button to pop out, to jump out is a good thing to do. Sometimes it could be red, sometimes it could be orange, sometimes it could be green. That, you know, the specific color isn't so much the issue is that it stands out or it jumps out. That's why I'm not a big fan of ghost buttons. And there have been some UX tests that have shown that people have a tendency to miss them. And, you know, that's just another proof point to the fact that when people are skimming and scanning, we want to make it, as marketers, as easy as possible for them to do what we want them to do, to click on that button.
So can you briefly, for those that might not know, can you briefly describe what a ghost button is?
Sure. I'm sure people have seen them, and now you'll know, you know, exactly what I'm referring to. But it's got the border, but there's no particular color. It just kind of has the background color kind of bleed through it. So, it, you know, it could be on an image. They just put the rectangle or the oval for the button there. So you've got the outline of it, but there's no color filled in.
Thank you for that. And for any marketers out there that have to go up and get, you know, CEO or, you know, VP approval for your email campaigns, feel free to cut that quote that says we're not in the business of making art, we're in the business of business. So feel free to cut that and play it for them, because I know that's a challenge for a lot of times. I think it's a great line, Nancy. You know, I want to shift a little bit to let's assume we convert the person and we talk about returns here. So I've talked to retailers in the past, and returns are one of these things now. I think it's one of the big battlegrounds for retailers now, and it's certainly challenging from a margin standpoint. But I've talked to retailers in the past that have extended their return policies, and say it was 30 or 45 days before, and they said, you know what, we looked at it and we started to push it to 60, 90 days, and they saw very little returns come in after the extended period. But those that did come in, there was generally a reason for the return. It turned into a customer service solution then, and a way to retain customers. So I want to talk a little bit about what this thing I looked up, they call it the endowment effect, which, you know, pretty much states the longer the customer has something, the less likely is they're going to return it. And that might be, you know, it might be a self-serving prophecy, because if you have apparel and you wear it 5 times, you might not be returning it. But is the endowment effect real? Does it match what you've seen in your experience, Nancy? And can you shed any light into just what this might mean for retailers?
Yeah, so it's a really interesting human behavior principle. What they found is we place greater value on things that we own. So once it becomes ours, we value it more. So if there's something that we want to get, well, obviously we value it. That's why we want to get it. But once we've actually acquired it, we place more value on it. Now that it's ours, we place even more value on it. We're that much less likely to want to part with it. So I think it's interesting that you're hearing that people pushing out their return policy to last longer is actually resulting in perhaps fewer returns, or at least resulting in returns that are more customer service related versus, I'm just going to return this now. The longer somebody has something, the more likely they are to keep it. Something interesting happened to me. This was a couple of years ago, but it fits this endowment principle perfectly. I had been doing Christmas shopping, and I was late in the game, right, doing some Christmas shopping, and I realized I'm never going to get these gifts delivered in time. But Amazon Prime was running a special, and they're like, we will guarantee that we'll get you the gifts delivered on time. And I thought, this is exactly what I need. So I sign up for Prime, and the gifts get delivered. We have a wonderful Christmas. Everything is good. And then some months passed. This was a couple of years ago. And I found I wasn't really using Prime. And I thought, you know what, I'm gonna cancel, and I'll get, you know, the rest of my money back, because I'm just not using it. So I go to their website, and I get to the page where I can do that. And they ask me a question. But the question wasn't, when do you want to cancel? The question was, when do you want to end your membership? And I thought that was so smart, because they're reminding me it's mine. And then they did something even smarter, in my opinion. They gave me two options. You know, when do you want to end your membership? And I could end now, which was ostensibly what I had come to the site to do, or I could click the end later button, which basically allowed me to finish out the term I'd originally agreed to. And I'll tell you, Greg, not only did I click end later, I am still an Amazon Prime member. So
that was my next question for you.
So I still am. So I think it was a really good example there of the endowment effect. You know, people just, the longer we have something, the more value we place on it. And when you position something or frame something as you're going to have to give up something that you already have, something that you already own, or you're going to lose something that you already have, people react, you know, very differently to that. I got an email once from a online wine company, and they wanted me to make a purchase. So they told me that I had a credit in my account that was going to expire. And I thought, this is brilliant. This is so much better than saying, make a purchase and we'll, you know, take $5 off, or we'll give you $5 back. They said, you know, essentially, you've got $5 in your account, but if you don't use it by, you know, tomorrow, you're going to lose it. And I placed greater value on that $5 because it was framed as my $5 as opposed to their $5 that they were going to give me. So good example there, too.
You never want to lose the credit you didn't earn, you know?
Right. But, you know, once it's mine, because it was in my account, that was very different, you know, than them saying, we'll give it to you. It's like, no, it's already mine. And I don't want to lose that, whether I earned it or not.
Those were two really good examples. And I, you know, when I was talking to these retailers that wound up pushing theirs out, their rationale was, well, listen, we normally didn't get a lot of requests after, say, it was a 30-day policy. So the ones that did come in, there was usually a problem. But they were trying to find a way to differentiate themselves, right? Because now everyone's expecting free returns, which is certainly a challenge and, you know, it costs money. They said, well, okay, let's just push it out 90 days and or 60 days and we'll see what happens. So it's interesting. I don't think they use behavioral science to make that decision, but they use a little bit of data and a little bit of gut feel to do it. But at least there's some science behind their decision. But personally, I look at this and I also, to me, it's like you talked about before, you start from the place of skepticism. Well, if I'm a consumer and I've never shopped with you before, and I've got two relatively equal retailers side by side, and one's got a 30-day return policy, and another's got 90, well, my skepticism gets broken down a little bit more on the 90-day side. Because I'm like, well, I got more time. They trust their products. They trust their brand. They, you know, so, and it's more consumer friendly. So I think it certainly ties in beyond just the endowment effect, but I think it ties in from what you mentioned before, from starting from a place of skepticism there and trying to overcome that.
Yeah, no, I agree. You mentioned a very interesting word. You said trust, and I think that totally comes into play, particularly when a site has that kind of a return policy or when they have a guarantee. It makes you, as the prospective customer, feel, well, I should be able to trust them because they've got this return policy in place, or because they've got this guarantee. And if you have to decide between a couple of competing vendors or companies, you might very well go with the one that has the guarantee or the one that has the return policy, just because of what it says about the company. Their product must be good or they wouldn't have that policy. Their product must be good or they wouldn't have the guarantee. You know, guarantee is one of those very, very powerful words because it removes risk. And so, you know, being able to have a return policy, being able to have a guarantee, basically telegraphs to people, this is a company that I can trust. I'm not going to regret my decision.
So I recently did a podcast on the reemergence of direct mail, and that's actually how we came into contact. So he had mentioned something as Dennis Kelly, and he had mentioned something about the science behind direct mail pieces. And I said, oh, I'm actually looking for someone. And he hooked us up. So thanks, Dennis. Shout out. But we were talking about how the physical element kind of factors in the marketing for retailers. And this might apply to the same thing we just talked about with if you possess something, you don't want to give it up as much. But direct mail, you're really just possessing a piece of paper for the most part. So if we apply that to the physical world, are the persuasive techniques that you spoke about, from call to actions and placement of things and colors and things like that, do those same things apply to when it comes to direct mail and just somewhat, you know, pieces in the physical world? Or are there some slight nuances between the physical and online world?
So a lot of the behavioral science that we've spoken about does cross over, whether it's online or offline or even in person. You know, some of these principles can apply whether you're, on the phone with somebody, whether you're face-to-face with them, whether you're writing an email or writing a direct mail letter. You know, the idea of exclusivity, the idea of scarcity, the idea of the authority principle, the idea of social proof, those have a tendency to be channel agnostic. There are certain things that are more channel specific. I mean, we talked about button color and ghost buttons, for example, which don't really come into play as much with direct mail, of course, but a lot of the principles do apply. And then, you know, then there are certain channel specific things. So for direct mail, you have the opportunity to touch something, which is nice. And there's something known as the science of haptics, which is basically the science of touch. And there's been a lot of research that's gone into it. And what the researchers have found is essentially what you touch is what you feel, which sounds kind of, you know, sounds like a little buzz phrase there. But, you know, if you're touching something that's soft, you know, you might come away with the idea that the company is warmer or softer. If you're touching something that's rugged and rough, you might come away with the idea that the product being advertised is, you know, very sturdy and well-made. So how something feels can actually start to influence how you're going to feel about it. And then there's just the idea of something being tactile, being one more way to attract attention. You know, as you're going through the mail, if something feels different than most of the other envelopes you're holding in your hand, maybe it's got a, soft touch paper, which feels just like it sounds, nice and soft, or maybe it has a, bubbles or lines indented in it, you know, some kind of texture, that's going to feel a little different. Or, you know, maybe if it's a postcard, it's got some kind of an aqueous coating so that it feels smooth, and or maybe it feels wet, or maybe it feels fuzzy. There are all kinds of interesting printing techniques that can be applied to postcards and self-mailers and outer envelopes that will help them stand out and make people pay attention to them. How a piece opens can make a difference. If you involve somebody because there's a zip strip, or maybe there's a series of die-cut designs, the longer somebody stays on a piece, it's been shown, the more likely they are to absorb the information and, you know, as a result, then respond. So there are a lot of interesting things that we can do with direct mail, just because it's an offline channel, an offline media. And so, it affords us some opportunities that we don't always get when we're online.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I've told the story before, so if you've listened to the podcast, bear with me for the next 30 seconds. But years ago, I used to do door-to-door sales. And it was, you know, they were like $20 things for restaurants and things like that. So they were actually decent values, but they were like these cards, almost like a big piece of foldable piece of direct mail. And one of the tactics they would teach you is try to put it in the person's hand, because once they touch it, they don't want to let it go. It's that possessive thing that you spoke about. So when you talk about the haptics, it fits perfectly with what we were trained to do from a door-to-door sales perspective as well. So very interesting you mentioned that. If you had to sit back and look at things and say, for a marketer that wants to use behavioral science in their marketing strategy, are there any traps that, you know, these people, I say these people, like there's some outcast generation. Are there traps that marketers fall into when trying to use behavioral science in marketing that maybe they're not aware of that they're falling into?
Now, that's a good question, Greg. Yeah, there are probably a few to a greater or lesser extent. I think one of them is you read one article about behavioral science or one book about it, and you think, okay, I've got the information that I need, and I'm going to be able to go and execute this flawlessly. And that's not necessarily the case. I mean, I always recommend, working with somebody who's kind of gotten their hands dirty in the past and, really kind of knows what they're doing, as opposed to someone who, heard one presentation or read one article and thinks, all right, I know all there is to know. So, one mistake might just be, the enthusiasm leading to overconfidence. And you can temper that by working with somebody who's got some experience and who's done this, in the past and run tests and, has a sense for what works. I think, another mistake, speaking of tests, is trying something once, and if you don't get the response you were looking for, assuming it doesn't work. And that's not necessarily the case. With behavioral science, there's a process you need to go through. You need to have your hypothesis. You need to figure out what it is you're hoping somebody's going to do. Why do you think they're not going to want to do it? Which behavioral science principle is the one that you want to test? And you might have a half a dozen of them. You might think, okay, social proof is going to be the one here, or loss aversion is going to be the one, or the scarcity principle, or the endowment effect. And so you have to test and figure out which one is really going to, give you the biggest bang for your buck. And if you just roll out with one of them and it doesn't give you those immediate response that you're looking for, a common mistake is to say, okay, well, this doesn't work. I'm just going to go back to the old way I was doing things. And you're just not giving the program enough run room to really figure things out. And then I think one other problem is that sometimes people say, oh, this is fabulous. If I do this, I'm going to be able to just trigger these automatic responses. And they start to, maybe use these techniques in a less than responsible way. And as marketers, I always say this, as marketers, we have to treat our customers and our prospects with respect. We have to, behave responsibly. And, for example, we know that urgency works. And if we say, today only, we're going to get an increase in our open rates and an increase in our conversion rates. So somebody who's not all that responsible might say, great, I'm going to say today only every day. And that eventually is going to backfire on you. And you start to lose the trust of your customers and your prospects. And eventually you just kind of hurt your brand and eventually your ROI. So I think those are some of the mistakes people make. They either are so enthusiastic that they're overly optimistic and feel they know everything that there is to know, even though they don't, or they test once. And if they don't get the response they're looking for, they say, okay, this doesn't work. Forget about behavioral science, or they try something, find that it works, and then they abuse it, which ultimately, has a ill effect on their brand. So those are just a few of the problems that might pop up when someone decides they want to use behavioral science in their marketing.
Marketers are never irresponsible, Nancy. You should know that by now. Okay, one last question. We're going to have some contact info on you in just a couple minutes, because certainly you can help with these things. If I'm an email marketer and I want to start applying some of these things, where would you suggest I start? Is it maybe playing around with some of those eye magnet words in the subject lines from just a ease of use standpoint? Where would you typically recommend an email marketer start?
Well, certainly the subject line makes sense, because if you can't get someone to open your email, you can have all kinds of wonderful things in it, but no one's going to get to it. So, optimizing that subject line and applying some behavioral science there is a very good thing to do. And whether that behavioral science has to do with eye magnet words or one of the other social science principles that we discussed, authority, social proof, the reason why, which is very interesting. Social scientists have found you're more likely to do what you're asked to do if you're given a reason why. So there are any number of them, but I would say, yes, starting at the subject line is a great place. And then following through in the, the body of the email, and then continuing through to the landing page. These are, each one of these represents an opportunity to optimize your creative approach and increase your response rates.
Very good answer. Nancy, did I neglect to ask you anything today that you feel is important for the audience to know?
I don't think so. I think you did a fabulous job. I've totally enjoyed talking to you, and I think your questions were good and spot on, and I hope our audience has gotten a lot of good information out of this.
Excellent. Nancy, you have any questions for me today?
So, you know, you've obviously been interested in behavioral science, and you've written about it, and I assume you've probably done some of your own testing with it. What's your favorite behavioral science and marketing story?
Oh, man, I should have probably prepared for something like this. So let's go with the subject line real quick, because that's something where when I was doing consulting years ago, it's an easy thing to test. And I think retailers should always be testing something. So it was something that you could gravitate to and say, okay, easy enough to automate the tests out and figure things out. So I liked it from that aspect. But what I traditionally found was if it was just a promotional message, you know, if you're testing certain things in subject lines, I always found that the results were somewhat negligible. You might get a 0.5% increase in open rate. And again, it's more opens than you had before. But I always looked at that and I said, well, you know, subject lines are somewhat indifferent. But then things started to change a little bit because the readership on mobile phones started to increase a lot more. And you mentioned before, right? You start truncating subject lines and conveying messages became harder and became more important to kind of put some thought behind that. And then emojis started becoming a lot more popular. And I'll tell you right now, and I told you before, emojis kind of stand out in subject lines to me if you use them the right way. There are certain things you can do there. So for the most part, I think that it's shifted a little bit. I still don't think I don't think any company is going to go, okay, we have a 14% open rate. We're going to get a 50% open rate if we use, you know, XYZ tactic. But I think there are opportunities now to use some of the things we talked about today to actually stand out and increase open rate. So that's one. It's probably not a great example, but it's kind of an example where your mentality has shifted over time. And I think that's the one thing where email best practices, you know, a lot of best practices, and I talk about this all the time, from 10, 15 years ago are still quote unquote best practices today. And I'm like, no, they're not. Like some of the things are still tried and true, but you got to adapt with the time. They always say, you know, change with the times and the times will change you. So it's probably not a great example, but it's an example of how looking at exactly what you talked about today has shifted. And I've seen that shift and I appreciate that shift now, but it's certainly is completely reflective of everything you said today. So I don't know if it's a great example for you, but it's an example.
Well, it's a good one. And you raise a good point. You know, you're not going to go from a, I don't know, 8% opening rate to a, you know, 58% opening rate, you know, by adding one of these techniques, but, you know, they all provide incremental lifts and they start to add up and add up and add up. And then, you know, in this business, sometimes, a little bit of a lift is all we need to give ourselves an edge. But anyone who comes in thinking, you know, I'm going to apply one of these techniques and it's going to completely turn my business around is going to be disappointed because that's not the way it works. And as marketers, we know we can't make people do something that they don't want to do, but we do understand that very often people are cruising along on autopilot and relying on decision defaults, and a well-placed trigger can push them, you know, or nudge them or prompt them to do what we want them to do. And it's not going to, you know, make you a millionaire overnight by any stretch, but, you know, these little changes, these incremental lifts ultimately pay off.
Yeah. And, you know, there's an old saying around the office, my old boss, Carolyn Sperano, used to say it all the time, shavings make a pile. Again, if I can get 10 more people to open this email, I've got a few more people looking the message. Say I get 4 of those to click, 1 to convert. I've got 1 extra customer. Now my post-purchase kicks in from an email standpoint. Can I convert that person again? All right. So your shavings do make a pile at that point. So from subject line to email creative, the landing pages to what you have on your website, to your social media usage, you spread that across the board. I think you have the opportunity to really drive incremental sales across a variety of different channels there, which is exactly what you want to do. I don't know. Was that a good enough answer for you, Nancy?
That was a great answer, Greg. Thank you.
All right. We got only a couple minutes left here, Nancy. I'm sorry. I'm keeping you a little bit long. I do want to peer very deep into your soul with a couple semi-rapid fire questions like I do to all my guests, if you're willing.
Of course.
Nancy, what's your favorite thing about what you do?
The fact that I'm constantly learning, you know, there's always something new to discover. There's always something new to try out. And, you know, so as a result, it never gets old, never gets stale. I always feel like I'm growing and I'm learning. And it's great to be able to help positively impact the business for my clients. And all of those things just, you know, make it worth getting up and going in the office every morning.
Very nice. What's your favorite restaurant? You said you're based in Newton, Massachusetts. So what's your favorite restaurant in the area?
Oh, gosh. So I am based in Newton, but I spent a lot of time in the summer on Cape Cod. And so right now, I happen to be on Cape Cod. So my favorite restaurant is the Lobster Pot. And they're in Provincetown at the very tip of the Cape, and they just do phenomenal seafood. And the funny thing is, I'm not necessarily a big seafood person, but I love the seafood there. So they're my pick right now for a favorite restaurant.
Very nice. Do you drink coffee? And if so, how do you take it?
I don't drink coffee. I'm a tea drinker. And in tea, I drink plain. I'm very low maintenance. As long as I've got a tea bag and hot water, I'm good. I don't need sweetener or cream or milk or anything.
You have a favorite type of tea? Darjeeling, Ceylon, chamomile?
It's a tie between jasmine and Earl Grey.
Very good. Is a hot dog a sandwich?
No, hot dog's a hot dog.
Dog's a hot dog. Very good. Two more for you. One, do you have any guilty pleasures? TV shows, music, anything like that?
I'm sure I must. It's a guilty pleasure. I wouldn't say this is necessarily a guilty pleasure. I'm a big Broadway fan. I love Broadway, and any chance I get, I'll see a show.
What's your favorite show? It's funny. I was interviewing someone just a couple of days ago, and they're a big Broadway fan as well. And I said, so I asked him what his favorite show was. What's your favorite show?
There's so many that I like, but one of my all-time favorites is Guys and Dolls.
All right. Very nice. All right, final question for you, Nancy. Would you rather be fluent in all languages and never be able to travel, or be able to travel anywhere for a year but never be able to learn a word in a different language?
Probably the latter. I love to travel, and I don't really, I studied Latin when I was a kid, in school. So I don't really speak anything fluently other than English. And people all over the world are very gracious, and I've always been able to get by.
Plus, you got Google Translate now, right? Helps you out.
This is true.
All right, Nancy, we will have info in the episode description about how to contact you. But if someone does want to reach out, what's the best way for them to get a hold of you?
We're talking about emails. They can certainly email me, and they can reach me at nharhut, N-H-A-R-H-U-T, at H-B as in boy, T as in Tony, hbtmktg.com, hbtmarketing.com.
Very good. And we will have that in the show description as well. So if anyone can pick up the spelling there, just navigate the description. You'll find it there. So Nancy Harhart, everyone, co-founder and chief creative officer at HBT Marketing. Nancy, thanks for your time. I enjoyed the conversation today. To those listening, especially our listener of the week, Melissa from Orlando, if you'd like to be the listener of the week, let me know you've tuned in. And if you're interested in telling your e-commerce or email marketing story, I'd love to hear from you as well. Until next time, have a great day and be kind to one another.